The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. Welcome to the Time of Monsters podcast on The Nation magazine. Although I guess for this week, since we're going to talk about Hollywood and its problems, perhaps the slogan we should use is "The old revenue stream is dying, and the new revenue stream struggles to be born." now is the time that the entertainment industry is in deep trouble. Hollywood just had the Memorial Day weekend, which is traditionally the sort of start of the big summer season, and it was the worst Memorial Day opening in decades. It's hard to actually figure out how many decades because of inflation and, different calculations, but at least since the 1990s, and perhaps even earlier, with Furioso being the latest of a string of big budget action movies that were expected to do very well that are underperforming, following the tradition of the Fall Guy and a whole slew of DC and Marvel movies. And it really looks like the sort of, while there are some Hollywood movies that are still successful and sometimes unexpectedly so, like Oppenheimer, it does seem like that model of the, action adventure blockbuster is not putting people in the seats anymore. And, by some calculations, ticket sales are down by 20% or arguably, like if we're just looking back from the last decade, like 50%, and that's a kind of a big problem. As it happens, fortuitously or maybe not, my guest, the historian Daniel Bessner, wrote an excellent piece in the May issue of Harper's that is really about the political economy of Hollywood over the last few decades, and I think it can perhaps offer some explanation as to what is going wrong. First of all, Daniel, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on, Jeet. And I, of course, was just on to talk about another Hollywood subject relatively recently, within the last couple months, I think.
That was Curb Your Enthusiasm, which is also a kind of a funeral subject, the end of a particular tradition of Jewish comedy.
Yes,
But
exactly.
yeah, we're here to be in a constant state of mourning
And mourning and panic.
and mourning and panic. Yes, but so I mean, to set up your piece, I mean, I think it quite properly focuses on sort of cultural workers and the working conditions of people in Hollywood, particularly writers in your essay. But it seems like there's been a real degradation of the kind of life that was enjoyed by cultural workers, that the kind of broad-based middle-class security that Hollywood once offered to people doing cultural work is really no longer there. So maybe I think that's a good place to kind of situate what exactly is happening.
Sure. And just to be clear, Hollywood was always a difficult industry to break into. But once one broke in, there was a level of stability that I think that has gone away. So just to be specific about what exactly has happened, it was never a particularly easy career to be a writer for film or television. But if you were able to break in and work on a bunch of different shows or sell a bunch of different movies, not even that many, you would be in the system, as it were, and you would be able to make a relatively stable middle class career. And I think that's gone away. So I think this is the product of what I imagine many nation listeners will be aware of, the dual trends of corporatization slash monopolization. They're kind of similar, and financialization. To make a long story short, in the first period of Hollywood's history, there was a studio system where talent worked on contracts for individual studios, the famous Big Five studios and then the Little Three, but basically eight major studios. In 1948, the Supreme Court issued something called the Paramount Decrees, and in effect, forced these vertically integrated companies that controlled production, distribution, and exhibition to get rid of one part of their business, and they chose the exhibition part because the movie studios actually owned theater chains. That happens in 1948. Over the course of the 1950s, you get the slow erosion of the contract system that defined the studio system era and the emergence of a more freelance economy, thereby getting rid of a lot of the protections that one had as an employee. And then in 1960, the Writers Guild, then the WGA, still the WGA, it had been something different earlier in its history, and SAG, the Screen Actors Guild, went on strike. It wasn't technically a dual strike. They went on strike at around the same time, basically forcing the studios to do a few things. Most important, to really institutionalize residuals for when television shows were rebroadcast as reruns or films were rebroadcast on TV. You got residuals if you were a writer or an actor. But even more important, to begin contributing to pension and health benefits, thereby creating in a freelance economy a sort of ersatz stable Fordist studio system. And that's basically the system that Hollywood lives under now. Unfortunately, what happened in the 1980s, the early 1980s, was that the Reagan administration came in and decided to no longer enforce the anti-monopoly Paramount decrees and various other laws and regulations that had encouraged competition. And so what you have over the course of the 80s and the 90s is the rise of the mega conglomerate. For example, famously on 30 Rock, they made fun of us with Shinehart Wigs, that Shinehart Wigs owned a bunch of different companies. That really only started at that scale in the 80s and the 90s and has excelled, expanded over the course. Yeah, over the course of the 2000s and 2010s. So you get the end of antitrust enforcement and anti-monopoly enforcement. Then what happens in the late 2000s is you get the increasing financialization of the economy, particularly in the wake of the Great Recession of 2007-2008. The government pumped a bunch of capital into the system, and it also lowered interest rates, which led the new types of financial institutions or financial institutions that had existed but really exploded in the era of deregulation, particularly private equity, hedge funds, and also index funds, which are connected but a little separate, to invest in Hollywood. And we get this era of peak TV, where there was an explosion of television shows. There was a gold rush mentality in Hollywood, and people started coming out here. And we all know peak TV, you know, went from 200 shows to 600 shows-ish. Then what happened in early 2022, in April 2022, Netflix, for the first time, which was this big disruptor with streaming that happened over the course of the 2000s and 2010s, announced that it had lost subscribers. And also, I believe it was in March, but I might have the date slightly wrong, the government started raising interest rates. And this essentially ended the gold rush period in Hollywood. And there has basically been a gigantic crash and a gigantic contraction in the entertainment business, which is basically my article traced that history, and there's a lot more detail, but that's sort of the potted history of what I talk about.
Yeah, no. And I think that offers a really good sort of explanation for the ups and downs. And now that you had mentioned it, I mean, it's maybe a little more of a personal thing, but it is kind of interesting that Reagan was there at the two different junctures of the changes that you talk about, that in the he had been part of the studio system and was successful as a kind of B actor within that, actually very well taken care of, and is actually like once the government tried to break up the monopolies that his career started to suffer. He no longer had that protection, and he kind of very wildly went into the Screen Actors Guild and became the kind of president to try to shore up and protect that. But then later, you know, as president, inaugurates the kind of era of deregulation. I mean, it's curious that it's interesting that even within the career of Ronald Reagan, you can see how all these the political economy of each era defined his career.
That's absolutely right. And it's funny, the end of sort of the B movie world basically ended with the regulation of Hollywood. Mm-hmm. Basically, studios weren't able to pump product into the theater chains that they owned for these various types of shows, show programs that they would do. But that's absolutely correct about Reagan being at the center of what went on in Hollywood in the 20th century.
Yeah. I think for like the the current era, it's interesting that a lot of the what we would consider the aesthetic side of things is very sharply influenced by the sort of political economy that you kind of outline. And particularly, like, you know, like this is a kind of industry of gamblers and speculators. And so they're very sensitive to interest rates. And a point I made in a sort of column riffing on your pieces, in a lot of ways, the sort of what we consider the aesthetic golden age of Hollywood of the 1970s really came to an end because of the Volcker shock. That, you know, like once the head of the Federal Reserve under Jimmy Carter started to raise interest rates in 1979, 1980, the kind of freewheeling Hollywood where they would take chances with people like Martin Scorsese and Francis Ford Coppola and give them a lot of rein in the movies that they were making, that came to an end, and Hollywood moved to a much more you know, what we could call aesthetically conservative mode of the you know, Spielberg and Lucas blockbuster Hollywood movies that were a much safer bet in an era of high interest rates.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the famous dialectical tension of the new Hollywood, right? Like, all these guys were friends, or a lot of them were friends, and then, mm-hmm. then you have the creation of the big temple structure, first with Jaws in 75, and then really with Star Wars, which shot it into the stratosphere in 77. But you also get, you know, Scorsese and Coppola, Apocalypse Now, and Taxi Driver, and movies like And so, I mean, unsurprisingly, Hollywood was more comfortable with one side of the new Hollywood equation as opposed to the other side. But one thing that's important is that what I hoped my article did was, or helped encourage, or will help encourage, is people thinking about the history of Hollywood through the lens of political economy. Because so often it's told through the lens of personalities and gossip, frankly. But it's really a business that is incredibly sensitive to the larger macro economy. And if we want, I wasn't able to really talk about this in the piece, but it really also relates to the larger histories of capitalism, like the falling rate of profit thesis, which I think is proved, I mean, it's not like provable or unprovable, but is articulated through the entrance of finance into Hollywood as well. Mm-hmm. Because if you think about it, and famously, Hollywood is not a very good business. It's a business of hits. There's a ton of misses. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes people lose money. And the fact that high finance entered Hollywood in the 2000s is, I think, a nice little demonstrator of the also fact that there's no real, there are not many places to invest anymore in the American political economy. So mm-hmm. they're investing in the media business. So we're sort of at the end of a particular cycle of capitalism. But the frightening thing is that it's very much unclear, as your podcast is about, what comes next. You know, what if the monsters are just here to stay? And that, I think, is more and more as my life goes on, and there's just total inability to address anything. It just seems like the time of monsters is just the time now. It is just normal time.
Yeah, no. I mean, that is indeed the scary thought. I mean, in terms of that falling rate of profit, and then the increasing reliance, you know, since really the slowdown of capitalism in the 1970s, the end of that, you know, post-war golden age, one has seen the system propped up by like a series of speculative bubbles. And I think for most of us, we famously think of the speculative bubbles as, you know, the dot-com bubble, the housing bubble. But you know, like Silicon Valley in a lot of ways, but all parts of the economy are subject to that. Hollywood, not least of all, in some ways, the Netflix bubble, the peak television bubble, parallels these earlier efforts to, like, you know, like try to find some magic formula that can, you know, like revive the beast.
Right. And there's just basically nowhere for capital to go. I mean, in the 19th century, you're literally building the United States, right? In the 20th century, you're expanding it through urbanization. In the 21st century, everything is built. So there's nowhere to get these gigantic returns that had basically pushed capitalism in the 19th and 20th century. So it's investing in the media business, which is a shitty business. You know, yeah. Like these private equity guys come and they just whatever, let's just say high finance comes and they want to like wring profits out of it, but there's nowhere to wring profits out of this business. It is totally random. So the only thing they could do is cut labor costs. Mm-hmm. And that is essentially the story of the last 10, 15 years is as this gold rush was going on, you got a degradation in the quality of Hollywood labor. And it's also the gold rush is a bit of, No, it's actually an apt metaphor because, interestingly enough, while the number of television shows seem to have gone up, there's been data that suggests that the number of episodes actually remained relatively stable or actually even went down a little bit as episode order. You know, you go from a 22-episode season of Law and Order to like a Netflix limited series of 6 episodes, you know, and so that's a big degradation in the quality of a writer's life and what they would make, to say nothing of the fact that the streaming network, the streaming services are totally basically unregulated. So that like those cables in the ground that deliver your cable TV are mega regulated. Those other cables that deliver your internet are almost totally unregulated. So you got the end of things like residuals for writers, which really kept writers alive. You got the development of shorter writer's rooms, because what matters on a streaming service is not 40 episodes, but is a new tile. So you could have 6 episodes of a new tile, and that's actually worth more than 30 episodes of something that you know, like, let's say Glow. Why isn't Glow in its 10th season? Because it was more valuable to put that money into new shows and therefore new titles. So you get the nature of the new delivery system also wound up degrading the lives of Hollywood talent.
Yeah, and in keeping with the theme that we've been sort of developing of like how political economy, is shaping everything, and there are real parallels. Like, it is also the case that a lot of the sort of innovative disruptions that Silicon Valley has brought have really rested on degrading labor and getting rid of previously protected jobs. One can think of the sort of taxi industry, right, and the value of a taxi license and a medallion, compared to what Uber brings, which it may be jobs for people who previously wouldn't have had jobs, but also like jobs that are
are just much worse.
Worse jobs. Yeah.
And that is because that's the only thing capital could do in 2024 or in the 2010s and 2020. There's just nowhere to invest anymore. They can't even really go to the global south, because you can't develop the global south too much. Otherwise, they'll challenge the United States, to say nothing of the real environmental effects of a completely industrialized global south. So capitalism finds itself in a strange position. And I think that it partly accounts for its sclerotic nature. There was always sclerosis in capitalism, of course, but it's been particularly egregious in the last generation or so, basically my adult life.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, this is a pretty dire picture that you're painting here, but I think an accurate one. And I think it's important to have, acknowledge these facts. Now, I think within, this kind of very bad system, people always have some degree of agency and have have fought for changes. And when one sees that, in the history of Hollywood itself, the first, the unionization that happened in the 1930s, and then again, the fights that once the system, the political economy was changing, the battle that you mentioned, in 1960 to kind of get residuals and to, create a new political economy, but also government intervention, as you mentioned, played a big role in creating a sort of Fordist system. Is there ways that we can imagine radical government intervention or labor militancy that could, at least change some of these dynamics?
It's imaginable. It's funny because the solution to this is obvious. Regulate the media. It's super, super obvious. There shouldn't only be 4 major companies in Hollywood, right? Disney owns everything. Should it be allowed to own everything? Should Comcast have 10 networks or whatever? It's 10 studios? Obviously not. It's just not going to happen. And then this leads to the other part of my grand theory of capitalism, is that Marx's prediction that we would become alienated for the system has been correct. Human beings don't have the will to control capitalism any longer. We're in the era of the mutual ruin of the contending classes. So that is the real, you said what I said before was pessimistic. That's really pessimistic. That's why Elon Musk wants to go to the moon, because unlike JP Morgan, he can't put his hand in the capitalist economy and push it in a different direction. It's too complex. The systems are so abstracted that it's very difficult to, for example, even an organized labor movement to pick a weak point in capitalism and go for it, because a minute you cut off one head and 4 others emerge. So it's imaginable for something to happen. I just think it's incredibly unlikely given the constellation of forces and the actual world in which we live. Now, there could always be a Watchmen-like exogenous shock, you know, the many tentacled dimensional hydra or whatever it was, octopus, that comes in and changes things. And there always is in human history.
In the sort of history that we're talking about, I mean, both the sort of the Great Depression and then World War II, like, you know, radically changed the nature of political economy and the role of the state and of labor within that system. So, I mean, it is something that has happened historically.
Yeah, I think that we're in terms of my problem with that is that the American state is now so gigantic and so complex that it wasn't the simple formation that it was in the 30s and the 40s that you could actually directly affect through things like mass organization. I mean, the state was just barely existent, like literally, like FDR creates the state through executive orders over the course of the 1930s and 1940s. And it's jerry-rigged. And in America in particular, not only is the state so complex, but because of various American ideologies, we have like these parastatal institutions that essentially function as state organizations, but have none of the regulation of a state organization. Most famously in my own, you know, area of expertise, foreign policy. The foreign policy establishment is not a government institution. It is a bunch of private, quote unquote, private groups that nevertheless have a direct influence on U.S. foreign policy. And they're like kind of regulated, but they're not really regulated, not like a state institution should be. Or the fact that our weapons are produced by private organizations. That's, you know, even a libertarian would say that's a naturally state function. But we have this weird public-private jerry-rigged system that is very, very difficult to control or push in a particular direction, as I think we all feel in a country with, you know, incredible crumbling infrastructure, two octogenarian presidential candidates, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think that's fair enough. And I think it's good to, you know, have a realistic sense of, you know, what the actual limits are. So, I mean, this would argue for a kind of pessimistic interpretation of the...
I prefer realism. You know, it's or, just like...
Particularly of the recent writer's strike and screen actors strike, where you know, like, there were gains that were to be gained won, but within your analysis, like, you know, as long as you have this, you know, these sort of quasi monopolies that have so much force, like, how much gains you can win within that system is very severely limited.
You can't make structural gains. My prediction is, much like academia and journalism, writing for film and television is going to become the provenance of rich kids, basically. I think that's kind of already happened. Like, and maybe you could get lucky and you could sell a show and blah 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 blah, but it's much more unlikely than it's ever been in American history. Basically, the Fordist creative middle class in the 2020s no longer exists for all intents and purposes. The professor, the journalist, the writer, it doesn't exist anymore. That was a product of the mid-20th century, and now it's over.
Yeah, no, and one actually sees that, like, in just the sort of biographies of people who go into these industries. It is very noticeable that in the early Hollywood, but particularly like in the 40s and 50s, you know, coming out of the WPA and other programs, even the GI Bill, which allowed a lot of working class people to go to, you know, like acting studios, and, you know, you got a real working class people, like, the sort of, you know, coming into Hollywood and getting jobs. And now I think a lot of the sort of Nepo baby discourse that we're seeing is a simple reflection of the fact that, like, really the these jobs are only available to people already, like, biologically plugged into the system, or at least the people who have those sort of biographical advantages have, like, a much greater chance than just an ordinary person.
And that's for two reasons. One, Hollywood is really a networking industry. Like, relationships do matter, because the talent side of the business is so unorganized that you actually need those relationships to get projects made. And then two, it's just because of the fact that, you know, if you have someone paying your bills, you're able to go out to more auditions and you're able to practice your craft, et cetera, et cetera. So it's partially unique to Hollywood itself, because if you're the daughter or son of a famous actor or actress, you have networks. And it's also the fact that if you're the daughter or son of a famous actor or actress, you're rich. And so they're paying for you to go out to a million auditions, which is, you know, if you're working at, you know, House of Pies in between running to auditions, you're much less likely to get a job.
Yeah. No. I mean, so, I think like where this discussion is going, it is towards the real structural limits of the system, and the kind of like the dire creative impact that that's going to have. And I think perhaps the one angle that we haven't really discussed is the way in which this dominance of private equity and these quasi-monopoly companies, because profit is harder to get, they also become more conservative in their choices. And I think that really explains the rise of IP and like very safe choices. In some ways, there's something like the DC universe or the Marvel universe, which no longer work, but to the extent that they worked, they were like a real sort of one of the gold rushes, because you had this pre-existing IP system that was locked up because the comic book industry was notoriously terrible for the the rights that it gave to creators. And this meant that one studio like Disney could own
Every character.
Narratives of thousands of characters, huh?
Yeah, it's really just accurate that and there's a bunch of reasons. Like you said, it's a proven product, so there's less risk involved theoretically with making a movie based on IP. It also gives, a lot of writers told me this one, executives sort of power over the thing, because if you're hiring a writer for a character that was already created, so you're able to manipulate the entire cinematic universes. Also in the era of high finance, you could do things like fund the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which is incredibly expensive and needs investment from these financial institutions. In fact, I believe Marvel Entertainment only was able to get off the ground in the mid 2000s due to like a gigantic Merrill Lynch loan. So there are lots of these imbrications of the system, to the degree where the guy who really studies this, Sujeet, you should have on, is Andrew DeWard, who's an assistant professor at the University of California, San Diego, UC San Diego. His book, Derivative Media, is coming out. Everyone should buy it if you're interested in this. He did the work, and in the late 1980s, the box office produced by the top 100 films, the domestic box office of the top 100 films, roughly 40% of that was produced by original stories. 40%. In the late 2010s, that's 6%. So you've seen a gigantic pendulum swing, to the degree where we're basically doing recycled content. And this is one that's kind of difficult to particularly trace. And another thing that's really important to do is that basically movies have been in decline since the early 1950s. And television is also in relative decline, given the rise of other ways of watching things. And if you think about it, YouTube is like the ideal thing for a studio, which is they pay zero production costs and they just get a cut of other people's work. And I believe some recent study came out that like 25% of all streaming time is watched via YouTube. So you also get the degradation and the decline of scripted content generally. It's not a surprise that like the people who watch CBS shows are generally older, for example. So Hollywood is even not reproducing itself. So the industry really faces a gigantic problem in the next generation or so, really big problems.
Yeah, no. I mean, it's hard to like take a look at your analysis, both in your excellent article in Harper's, which I'll link to, and which everyone should read, and but also what we've been discussing here, without like realizing how deep the crisis is. And but perhaps the note I'll end on is like, we know for the history of capitalism, over the last few centuries, every crisis is not really permanent. Like there has to be some sort of resolution. The contradictions play themselves out, either in like some sort of economic collapse or in the development of something new. So I think it's the interesting thing for me, although it's impossible to know where we're going, is like there has to be something that comes next.
Yeah, it could be worse.
That's a great note to end on. So again, thank you, Daniel Vestner,
Thank
for
you, Jake.
being on, and I'll encourage everyone to read your article.
Yes, please do.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, Our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.